Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. As truthful as resources permit, Jazza, I wanted to start this podcast by asking you, if you were the UK's official censor, which commentator would you ban from the airwaves?
I'll be honest, Jimmy, that isn't the question that I was expecting from you. A commentator, as in kind of like just any Tom, Dick or Harry on Twitter?
Any pundit, yeah, like it could
I mean,
be,
you're quite high up on the list, I'll be completely honest.
I expected that answer, but let's exclude me from the list just for the sake of having an interesting answer to this.
How interesting. I mean, the obvious one, is this just a way of trying to get me to talk about Tom Harwood?
I was hoping that you would bring him up, actually.
I thought you would.
Has he been particularly abrasive lately?
Oh, like all of the Brexiteers are just smug, including you, young man. I'm not removing you from that.
I'm trying to move away from Brexit-related Twitter content into more free speech-related Twitter content.
Oh, no. I'm never letting you forget. Don't you worry. We will never move on.
That is the endless cry of the Ramona. So we'll take Tom Harwood,
though. In its natural habitat, its own podcast. Welcome to The Right Dishonourable, dear listener. Thank you very much for tuning in. We meet every now and again to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. I am Jazza, and this is my troll friend Jimmy. What are we going to talk about this week?
I thought we would start off this week by discussing the Russia report. I mean, I say I thought, but Jazza, as he pointed out to me before we started recording, suggests all the topics for this podcast now. So it was more his idea.
I literally do, but I do. I'm quite philanthropic, I think, because I suggest topics for both of us. I suggest stuff as kind of like, well, this is a Jimmy topic, this is a Jazza topic, and this is a topic where Jimmy can annoy Jazza, essentially.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, this is the report from the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee into Russian interference into British democracy. Obviously, this has been a bit of a talking point, particularly for, avoid the use of the word Ramonas, but let's say hardcore Remainers who are upset about what happened those glorious 4 years ago, and have sort of insinuated that
how have you been celebrating our leaving of the European Union, Jimmy? You don't seem to be really leaning into that very hard.
Have we left yet, really? I mean, I know we've left on paper, but I still feel we're very firmly in the building at this point.
But we're getting hard and fast kicked out at the end of the year. So, I mean, I hope that your party planning is well underway.
Well, I mean, lockdown has put a bit of cramp on partying, but we can have a bit of a shindig if you want.
You know what? Let's do a Zoom quiz or something. That would be nice.
Yeah, that's not depressing whatsoever. But this report, it didn't really support the thesis that Russia directly interfered in the EU referendum, and it certainly didn't support the thesis that the Russian messaging around the EU referendum had a material impact on how people voted, although, as it says, I think it would be difficult to prove that one way or the other. But it did suggest that Russia has inveigled its way into British politics in various ways, including the use of, let's say, online bots and articles posted in Sputnik and Russia Today. And also the fact that there's a lot of Russian money sloshing around the British economy in various forms. And a lot of Russian oligarchs is obviously the preferred term, who live here and do a lot of business here. It was quite comprehensive beyond the obvious Brexit-related headline.
Yeah, to be honest, not an awful lot was about the EU referendum. It was about Russian interference with British democracy in general.
Yes.
And kind of because of that, there is the, like, depending on whether you listen to the Guardian the Guardian, or if you listen to, I don't know, I've stopped listening to things that make me stressed, then it's either the most damning report ever to come out about the government ever, and it's on the verge of the collapse, or this proves that there was no evidence of Russian canoodling in the European, in the EU referendum, and frankly, neither of those things are true. Funnily enough, it's somewhere in the middle. But we'll talk about it, I guess.
Reluctantly.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of spies, and not just Russian ones in particular, the second topic we're going to be discussing is masks. That was a slightly pained segue.
I don't...
Spies okay. mask themselves, they disguise themselves, and now every... It was quite bad. We're recording this on the 24th of July. From today, British people are required... Well, I should say English and Welsh people are required to wear masks indoors when they go shopping. There are a few exemptions for restaurants and pubs and that kind of thing, but it basically means when you're out and about, if you're in a confined space, you're expected to have a mask on, unless you're exempt for sort of medical reasons or if you're a child. So, I mean, I feel like the adherence to the rough, you know, the rough suggestion from government that you should wear a mask has been about 50-50 when I've been out and about, in the sense that about half of people have already been wearing masks for a while when they're in shops. It seems as though this has upset some people. There is an anti-mask brigade that thinks that this is a terribly damaging thing for British society, that we're all expected to wear masks. But I suspect we're probably going to fall on the same side of this one, aren't we?
The biggest offence that they have, or the biggest qualm that seems to come up very often, is it's uncomfortable and hot, in which case, get a more comfortable mask. Or it steams up your glasses so people with glasses can't see. And, I mean, if you want, I can show you a very good tactic, because I wear glasses, and you just perch the glasses on top of the mask, and it's fine.
It is, yeah.
But it is kind of like the anti, I don't want to, like, government can't tell me what to do kind of sentiment that sometimes rears its head in the UK. But I also assume that we're going to land on the same side of this argument. Oh, but how exciting. Let's find out in the segment.
And finally, one topic that we will not be landing on the same side of the argument, I don't think, is the various kerfuffles that have been going on in recent weeks around free speech. I mean, it's been more than a month since we last recorded one of these, and I think there's been, for some reason, it's been a very antagonistic time for free speech. I mean, it is connected to some of the things that are going on around the Black Lives Matter protests, but probably the most significant event was the signing of the letter in Harper's magazine, an open letter against cancel culture, which is a phrase that, to be fair, the letter itself doesn't use, but I think from the examples they list, it's very clear that's what it's aimed at. And basically, some public intellectuals think that, you know, the fact that a lot of people have lost jobs over saying things indelicately or expressing political opinions that are unpopular in certain quarters is bad for society at large. Which is a view I'm sympathetic to. Jazza, where roughly do you land on this?
I think it's less of an issue than those who signed the Harper letter would have us think.
So you think maybe some of the people complaining about cancel culture are overreacting, in your view?
I think so, yeah. Because cancel culture is only as... like, a lot of the people who signed that letter would say that they have been cancelled, and most of them appear to be doing fine.
Well, Salman Rushdie is on the list of signatories, and his life has been, you know, totally changed by the fact that somebody ordered him to be killed for something he'd written.
Yeah, but I don't know. We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about it.
I'm actually evolving on the issue. Obama style. But we'll talk about it.
We will talk about it. Now we will play some music and beg you for money, I suppose. I guess we're still doing that. Mm-hmm. And then we'll crack on with the main podcast.
Love that for us. Wonderful. Gorgeous.
If you like what we do at the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. It's a fairly conventional Patreon account, and I'm sure most of you know how that works, so I won't bore you with any further details. A big thank you to our existing patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Ollie McGregor.
Jimmy, this was widely touted, the Russia report from the Intelligence and Security Committee from Parliament, was touted as kind of like the conclusion to whether or not Russia had interfered and possibly altered the result of the 2016 Brexit referendum.
Sure, yeah.
It was, however, actually just one single case study in a that I think was less than 10 pages of a 50-page document, and it was more about Russia's espionage and attempts to get involved in British democracy more widely.
Yeah, definitely.
What was your biggest takeaway from the Russia report?
I think the biggest takeaway in some ways is not that sexy, and I think the obviously with the Brexit thing, that's a fairly heated issue, I think it's fair to say, and it's one that sort of draws people up on fairly simple sides of things. So I think it's understandable that a lot of people, when this came out, did...
It's almost like it's unhealthy to ask people a yes-no question on a really nuanced topic, isn't it?
I'm not taking that bait. But
I'm about nothing in particular, just in general,
just
you know?
In general. Maybe we should stop this whole voting malarkey. Just asking ignorant people their views on things. It's not going to work.
I'm glad you said it.
But I think to return to my original point is that even though the Brexit angle is the more newsworthy one in some ways, the big takeaway from this report is essentially just a resources one. I think it's that British security services and intelligence services have been focused on counterterrorism basically since 9/11, and the potential threat from Russia, and I suppose you can kind of extrapolate that a lot of this might also apply to China as well in the future, has not been focused on enough. Like we haven't spent enough time and energy trying to counter what the Russians are doing at a time where Russia seems more and more willing to attack our institutions in various ways. I mean, the democracy thing is the top line, but you also have cases of I mentioned it in the intro, of Russian money working its way through British businesses, you know, not all of it probably of an entirely legitimate origin, let's say. You have a whole... The report says that there's a whole professional class of people who are basically help to serve as a front and protect these Russians that have come over here. Mm. These very wealthy Russians.
They referred it to I can't actually believe that this wasn't an official report, but they quoted Londongrad. It's kind of like a common word.
Yes, they did.
Section of the British economy.
And I think the Metro, the sort of daily free newspaper that gets given out in London, actually led with a headline that referenced Londongrad as well. And you know, there is something to that narrative anyway. But aside from that, you've got the sort of murder of Alexander Litvinenko as well, which was back in...
Keeps on being brought up as kind of like a watershed moment in, as you were going to say, 2006, right?
2006, yeah. Who was poisoned via a cup of tea, I think I'm right in saying.
You got to give it to them, though. It's fucking poetic.
It's very on brand, in a way, when you're attacking the UK, at least. But and then there was the Skripal attacks in Salisbury more recently, which the report does notice actually did lead to the British organising a pretty effective diplomatic response involving the expulsion of various Russian agents from a number of countries in Europe. So I mean, there is evidence that the British security services are pivoting back towards focusing on Russia and devoting more resources to Russia. And I suppose there are also calls among military people to do similar things in a more conventional sense as well. I think there's a sense that, you know, for the last 20 years the British military have been focusing on sort of insurgency and that kind of thing, and people are sort of looking more to what is referred to as sort of great power or peer competition, so fighting between countries rather than between a country and a non-state actor, as it would be called.
A non-state actor being like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, yeah, or something exactly along those lines, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the lines are not entirely neat, because obviously a lot of states do end up funding or have some relationship to non-state actors, but I still think the term is relevant and meaningful to enough of a degree that it's worth using. But to me, that is actually the big thing about this report. It's actually the pivot that needs to take place in terms of resources. Because essentially the implication is that not enough focus has been put on this, and I suppose you can argue about it, that then sort of feeds back into the politics of all this. I mean, there's a piece in The Guardian by the columnist Martin Kettle that criticised the intelligence services for not sort of staking a claim directly to some of this democratic interference activity that's been going on. The security services have been nervous about doing that because, obviously having...
They don't want to be seen to be getting... I mean, the report mentions it. They don't want to be seen to be getting involved in politics.
Exactly, yeah. That's all understandable. I mean, I'm not really sure I agree with Martin Kettle on that point, but I think... there is obviously a need to actually to take more action in terms of stopping attempts to interfere with British democracy. I think calling it interference, maybe implies that it is actually having an impact, and it is hard to ascertain that that's the case. I mean, there have been reports for ages about Russian bots like spewing out political advertising and propaganda in relation to the Brexit vote. There's also references to
and more legitimate looking. Yeah, and more legitimate-looking media outlets as well, outside of just bots, like the likes of Russia Today, and Sputnik as media outlets that are designed or deliberately try and provide more, like to unsettle the conversation maybe that's happening around a particular topic just for the sake of it. I think I'd agree with you in terms of that being a response... one of the major takeaways. I think also I was really shocked at how fragmented the responsibility for things like counter-espionage and ensuring the protecting of democracy is across all of the government departments, some of it coming under the Duchy of Lancaster, some of it coming under the security community. I know you love that word.
Intelligence community.
Sorry, yes, the intelligence community. I apologise.
I should slightly explain that.
I
generally think community is a bullshit word that implies a level of cohesiveness that usually doesn't exist. So, like, the LGBT community doesn't really exist as such.
I find your battle of semantics quite boring. So let's move on.
It's particularly absurd in the case of the intelligence community. These people are spies. They don't know each other by definition. Anyway, classified information, all that. Please continue.
You know what they mean. You know what they mean. Don't be so butthurt.
Just say intelligent personnel. I mean, would it kill you just to say that? That would be fine. Continue.
Okay. I'm sure that you'll be sending them back your marking of their report, Jimmy.
Stylistically, this report leaves very much to be desired, I would say, although it's quite readable, so swings and roundabouts.
It was very chatty. I found it quite easy to read.
Yeah.
That was kind of like a big part of it too, and also the calls for international cooperation. Which I don't think we are necessarily incredibly good at, the calls of the West working in unison together, and the West being most effective against these kind of espionage actions. It's not necessarily attacks, but actions. It's strongest when it's together, and that is particularly hard when you have a United States that's seen as retreating from those kinds of responsibilities on the world stage under Trump, and the UK not having the best relationship with the European Union at the moment either. I thought that those were two very important pieces of kind of like things that they highlighted. Would you agree? You don't have to, love.
No, I think that does make. I mean, I think the evidence from the Salisbury response is that the UK was quite effective in organising something there. Obviously, the UK's international reputation is not what it was 5 years ago, let's say, for obvious reasons that we'll try not to go into too much. But I mean, I think it's been quite normal actually for Britain's military and security ties to run parallel to the European Union. The European Union has not been a particularly effective or a particularly comprehensive, I should say, defence arrangement. I mean, NATO is much more important to British security than the EU has ever been. There's been stuff around joint procurement and joint exercises between European militaries, and some of that stuff is ongoing and is effective, you know, in as much as its remit is. But I think you might be being a little bit harsh in your assessment there. But yeah, I think it does stand out that at a time where Britain is obviously severing economic and political ties to the European Union for the sake of its security, it does still need to actually maintain those kind of ties against Russia.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted
a little
you
bit
to
unimpressed
that,
by. Okay.
Okay. I mean, moving on to. Go on.
No, something that did actually I thought was quite interesting actually, since we've sort of mentioned international reputation, is that there's a bit that because Russia's international brand, let's say, is seen as so poor, it actually makes it more willing to take high risk strategies such as the annexation.
I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting as well. And they literally use the phrases. It's almost like they have nothing to lose. Mm. There was an opening thing. Like they go into basically all. I didn't realize it was going to go as far back as kind of like the Cold War and like lay out the relationship that we have with Russia, like coming out of the 1980s and into the 1990s. But yeah, I thought that was a really interesting, like, it basically read Russia for filth for a good few paragraphs, basically saying, like, obviously they're super weak as well. Oh, no, here it is. Russia has a small population compared to the West, a lack of both reliable partners and cultural influence outside the countries of the former USSR, a lack of strong public and democratic institutions, including the rule of law, semicolon, and, of course, a weak economy. And I was like, zing!
I mean, the Russian economy is heavily based on oil, and oil is not doing very well at the moment, so... I mean, the population thing strikes me as kind of untrue. Russia's population is, what, like 150 million, which is quite large by any standards. But quibbles, I guess, quibbles. I mean, it is interesting that, and I think, again, to draw a comparison with the China situation, for sort of around the same time, actually, during the 90s, there was a rapprochement between... the West and Russia and the West and China, sort of the opening up of China economically to the world, and attempting to convert Russia into, let's say, what we could call a normal democratic country. And both of those things have kind of failed in a sense. I mean, the Russia thing has failed because Russia has reverted into a dictatorship basically run by Vladimir Putin. And China has, the hope with China was that when, as it economically liberalized, it would also enact political reforms in that direction as well. And that has also not happened. So, yeah, I think it, you know, that parallel is quite interesting more generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Moving on to the European Union referendum section of this, the big takeaway that seemed to be. I think that they were encouraged to talk about this when they presented this report in person with journalists. They were encouraged to talk about the fact that it was actually really hard for them to assess Russian involvement with the European Union referendum because of the fact that the government had deliberately not sought to kind of like investigate it at the time. And so there was a very small amount of resources for them to actually be able to work through and to assess and look at. And for that reason, they weren't able to conclude whether or not there was Russian tampering. And that is why a lot of political a lot of Brexit leaning media are saying that this is proof that there was no I want to say collusion, but that's a Trump word. But there was no attempt to from the Russians, right? Thank you. That is the word I wanted. Whereas that isn't true. It just, they made it really, really clear that they were shocked when they presented this. It's less so in the paper, but with the presentation on the earlier this week, they were very much strong in expressing the fact that they were shocked that the UK government hadn't taken it more seriously at the time. And made sure that there was a proper assessment of this. And then that has been unpacked to suggest that they didn't really care. They didn't want there to be any kind of a paper trail that would be able to undermine the referendum. And then there was also the delay of this report, which I think we can't ignore. This was meant to come out in autumn last year before we had the general election in 2019, which gave Boris Johnson his majority, and I don't think it would have necessarily, this kind of report is never going to sway a whole election. I don't think the British population just wouldn't be that interested in it, but they have waited to release it until after we're allowed to extend the period of us leaving the European Union. And that just, I mean, for me,
this is a conspiracy allegation,
face, right?
Isn't it?
I guess, but talk me out of it then.
Well, what was the reason given for the delay? Was there any explanation offered? Because I know it said that this report had to be heavily vetted by the intelligence services. Was that the reason?
But it already had been vetted. It was ready in autumn.
So why was it delayed then? What was the explanation? Or was
they
none
said
offered?
I understand that some of the responses were it wasn't relevant anymore, but other than that, I'm not aware of any other excuses that were given.
I mean, the thing is that it actually strikes me as quite bemusing that the Tories wouldn't want this released before the election, because essentially the gist of the report is that Russia is attacking the United Kingdom, you know, through this various means. There's two things there. Obviously, the Tories are much stronger. The perception is they're much stronger on security and the national interests than Labour are in general. But specifically, Corbyn was viewed as very weak.
Very, very weak.
Specifically in relation to the Salisbury attack, but more generally in relation to Britain's enemies, let's say. I'd have thought if this was released, I mean, probably what, if this had been released in autumn, say 2 months before the general election, I think it would have just sunk without a trace and not had any impact, really. But had it been released in the run-up to the election, or as close as possible to the election as it could be, I'd have thought this would have been good for the Tories on balance. I guess you can say because the Tories have been in government for the duration of the period that's under discussion here, you can actually blame them for a lot of the problems that have arisen. But at the same time, you have that general reputation thing. The Tories are seen as stronger on security. Mm. So, I'm not saying you're wrong.
You haven't.
I'm just saying that I think you can well argue it the other way, actually, that it would have been a good thing to release prior to the election.
Then why didn't they? And frankly, that didn't talk me out of my conspiracy theory, so I'm very happy to continue parroting it whenever people bring it up. Shall we move on to face masks?
Yeah, we can move on to face masks, actually. How many do on your person?
Oh, I have a couple. Some of them are quite fashionable, actually. But I have a schnood that I can sometimes put in over my face to cover my mouth. And then I have a couple of masks as well that I have in rotation. One of them is really quite lovely and brings out the blue in my eyes. How about you?
I think I've only got one that I pinched off my girlfriend, and she wants it back. So I need to make significant purchases.
You are
going
to have
masks.
To invest.
Yeah. Which is going to be devastating for me economically.
So as a great defender of one's right to choose and freedom, Jimmy, how do you feel about the compulsory guidelines for wearing face coverings in shops, supermarkets, shopping centres, and transport places. Coming in England from today, the day that we're recording this, actually, the 24th of July. Are you butt hurt? Does it make you sweaty?
I will be honest, it's not the most pleasant thing to wear. I would, from a comfort point of view, I would prefer not to wear it, but it does seem to me that we've just undergone the greatest restriction of civil liberties in the UK since the Second World War, and things are loosening up, and to aid that loosening up, they're going to impose, they have been imposing certain measures, and one of them is wearing of masks. So I think the pro-freedom thing to do really is just to wear the mask. Like, I see where people are coming from a principle point of view. I get the argument. I just think it just seems kind of impractical to oppose wearing masks. And I mean, no offense to the sort of libertarian commentators generally, or maybe just libertarians more generally. They don't seem the most practical people, I think. They make demands that are very clearly not going to be implemented or be popular. And I think sometimes you just have to make compromises in politics. Crazy as it sounds.
You know what's fantastic about criticising the libertarians? It's that they can't be annoyed that you're criticising them. Because you have the right to do that through freedom of speech.
I mean, that isn't what the right to free speech means.
it's 100% what it means.
We'll cover that later. It is funny to me, and there has, some people have pointed out the overlap between Brexit voters and people who seem upset about the masks. I think I referenced earlier that there are some people that are saying it's going to ruin the social fabric of society because people will no longer be able to see facial expressions. That seems to me just untrue. I mean, I'm not saying there's no cost there at all. I think they're probably just over-egging the pudding a bit. To put it nicely.
What do you think is the line that runs through Brexiteers and the hate of the mask?
I think it's actually probably just a straightforward thing that there is now a, depending on what circles you run it, I mean, there's no official Brexit party as such, although you could argue that Vote Leave has...
I mean, there's literally a Brexit party.
Does that still exist? Does the Brexit party still exist?
I think so. Yeah, they have like councillors and stuff, don't they?
I'll have to check that one. Okay, but apart from them, which, but do you know what I mean? There's no like, I mean, that party is severely sunk since its victory in the European elections, whatever. I guess that was 2019.
They have four members in the Welsh Parliament, Jimmy.
Okay, I stand corrected. But outside of that, there's sort of a clutch of like commentators and people that appear in various news outlets and stuff who are kind of, they're sort of like the intellectual wing of the Brexit movement, I guess you could say. And I think that clearly among some of them, they decided this mask thing was not good, I think for libertarian reasons. And I sense it's sort of like a mass peer pressure groupthink thing, really. It's like, well, these people are on my team and they're saying this thing, so presumably I should also say something similar. That sounds quite defamatory. I just think that is actually how a lot of politics works. So that is, I don't think there's any logical line. Do you know what I mean? In the same way that there's nothing logical really about denying climate change and opposing people's right to have an abortion. And yet those two things do seem to, you know, more likely sit alongside each other than not.
I think that some of the people who... God, look at me defending people who think that women shouldn't have abortions. But I think that there is logic there. Like, I don't think it comes from necessarily irrational things, but then you are a lot less forgiving of people who are religious, shall we say.
Oh, so I'm not saying there aren't good reasons to... I'm not saying there's not logical reasons to oppose abortion. I'm saying there's no logical connection between opposing abortion and thinking that climate change isn't real. Do you see what I mean?
Right, okay. No, I'm with you. Yeah.
It's more like there's sort of like collections of policies which ostensibly have no relation to one another, but because they become part of a... you know, a political movement or something, then they sort of become tied up together, and you often find the same people spouting roughly the same lines across a load of different issues that, as I say, don't have much connection to one another. And I think that's just what's. I mean, there's probably quite a few. If you go back over time, you can see, you know, Brexiteers picking certain battles, and I mean, you could say the same of Remainers as well, right? Like, there's some stuff that a lot of sort of out and proud Remainers would subscribe to that doesn't seem to have much to do with the EU per se. But yeah, I think that's just the way politics works. But it's been kind of amusing to watch, I think, and it's probably not done the Brexit movement a great deal of credit, although, you know, maybe it doesn't have much credit to begin with.
I mean, they're literally the people running the show now, so I think the Brexit movement is doing fine. when we're looking at... I'm just shocked when we know... So we know that face masks are... Particularly, they're not very good at protecting you from other people's germs and viral loads, for example. But they're very good at stopping you from passing on whatever viral load you have. There's even with like cloth masks and non-surgical masks, it can be really quite powerful. I think that some of it is literally the fact that there's not a huge amount of benefit for you. You're doing it for someone else, for the good of somebody else. I don't know, maybe I'm being unfair. I am definitely being unfair, but maybe that's a difficult jump for people to do with maybe more of a Brexit tendency. All offence men, Jimmy.
Maybe. I mean, it's a pretty... I mean, one of the ironies, I suppose, of this is that a lot of the... Well... It seems to be that some people sceptical about lockdown and the masks are from like this kind of libertarian economics background. And if you've even the vaguest interest in economics, you'll understand the concept of a negative externality, which is a cost that somebody else pays when a transaction takes place. So if I like use some petrol, it doesn't really hurt me directly, but it does damage the environment because you're burning petrol and that's releasing fumes into the atmosphere and so on. And usually the way to actually...
Allegedly damages the environment. Thank you, Jimmy.
Okay, fine. Usually that sort of thing would be offset by a tax. That would be like the traditional way of doing that, so that, you know, in some way that disincentivizes certain activities or it allows you to mitigate it through some sort of public spending or whatever. But yeah, it's you could probably, somebody probably already has done a very extensive diagram of the links between Tufton Street, which is where all the neoliberal think tanks live, and the Brexit movement, because there clearly is some overlap between those two things. I wanted to ask you, actually, because something that I think is in the favour of the mask sceptic side, actually, is that the messaging initially around masks is that they weren't very effective and people were being discouraged from using them. And my understanding of that was that it was to protect the stock of masks that needed to be used for kind of discrete medical cases.
Why they haven't been made, they weren't made compulsory until now, right? Because we didn't have enough masks.
But there were public health experts. I mean, there's clips of them I've seen circulating on social media that were saying that the masks just weren't effective in preventing the spread of the disease. And even at the time, and as you know, someone who's ignorant about most medicine, I thought there was something a little bit implausible about that. That, you know, it seemed unlikely that it had no ability to reduce the spread of the virus. Just because, you know, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a doctor, but it just sort of seemed like common sense that it would. And I guess I wonder. I mean, this is a general criticism you can put towards Boris Johnson's government's handling of the coronavirus. It's so much of the messaging has been so mixed and so conflicting, and you've got the disparity between guidelines and legislation. And I mean, even when the certain politicians were saying, "Oh, we need to impose mandatory mask wearing," there were footage of them out and about not wearing masks. Mm-hmm. Which seems wrong, do you know what I mean? It just seems a basic lack of public messaging skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And they haven't been very good on messaging. We haven't been very... actually, messaging more than anything has been the big shocker in terms of how bad this government have dealt with the coronavirus outbreak, which is shocking when you see it as Boris Johnson and everybody used to like brown nose him till kingdom come about how good he was at engaging with people and with messaging, get Brexit done, all of that stuff, although that wasn't his phrase. But yeah, I think it just shows their incompetence. But what, watch them get away with it. Like, that's what I'm, that's how I feel.
The government's still polling okay, isn't it? It hasn't, doesn't seem to have suffered massively, despite some of the
Boris Johnson
obvious
isn't
problems.
Doing very well. Boris His Johnson's ratings. Individual ratings are down, yeah. And I think Keir is now preferred prime minister. But like economically and all things like that, Boris Johnson still beats him. But overall, in terms of the preferred prime minister, Keir Starmer, for those of you who don't know, the leader of the Labour Party, is it's polling ahead of him.
I think this is a slight tangent from what we were talking about, but I think the risks of Boris Johnson being turfed out before the next general election have massively increased.
Oh yeah, no. That would, Keir is going to be going up against Rishi Sunak.
You reckon?
Obviously.
Is this a famous Jazzer John gut feeling prediction?
Yeah, I think so. although I do, I think that there is going to be an attempt by because oh god, I've forgotten his name. Duchy of Lancaster.
Michael Gove.
Michael Gove, thank you. Jesus, what happened there? There's Michael Gove is going to do everything that he can in order to be able to be the next prime minister, because you know that he wants it more than anything. But it would be quite fascinating to see how he slows down or stops the Rishi Sunak steamroller.
I think also in the last contest, he proved himself to be quite unpopular among other Tory MPs.
The Tory MPs hate him.
That seems a pretty big drawback when that's the first barrier you have to climb over to become leader.
That is fair. That is fair. We'll see. But I still reckon my... Yeah, Jazzer John prediction. You know what the official prediction is going to be? That Rishi is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. All other bets are off.
But that means that Boris Johnson could contest the next election and lose, and then Rishi Sunak will step into his shoes.
I'm hedging.
That is definitely a hedge on your original offer, but we'll take it for the time being.
To be fair, the next election is like 4 years away at least, probably, unless they do a snap one next year or whatever. So let me hedge.
You can hedge. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I think they have. Have they repealed the Fixed Term Parliaments Act? I think that's ongoing.
I don't think they
isn't
have.
It?
They.
So it mm-hmm. probably will be sometime in 2024, if I've done my maths right, which is possible that I haven't. I think
they've
correct.
Got plenty of time to repeal the Fixed Term Parliament.
They
Act,
do. Yeah.
So that's on them.
That is on them. Okay, should we talk about free speech to finish this off? I know this is a topic that you're deeply interested in and love to discuss at length.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you were actually saying...
Well, go on.
You were saying in the introduction that you think that the likes of J.K. Rowling and Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis and Anne Applebaum are overstating the problem when it comes to cancel culture, you know, particularly people losing their jobs for expressing certain ideas, perhaps in an indelicate way, or, you know, perhaps just, you know, giving their opinion on something that proves controversial. You think this is less of a problem, or like, I mean, do you think it's a good thing sometimes when people get sacked or lose their job for something they've said?
So for that particular question, it depends on the job, doesn't it? If something that you have tweeted about or talked about or expressed an opinion about makes it difficult for you to be able to do your job effectively because of the fact that you hold that opinion and that you have broadcasted that opinion, that makes some people in some roles continuing to do some roles untenable, and that makes sense.
Could you give an example?
Most people for example, a hypothetical of somebody working in a women's shelter who says anti-trans things on Twitter, for example. That women's shelter may have a or should, frankly, have a policy to protect women who are cisgender and who are trans, and but you have an employee who goes against that ideology and that mission statement of the company, for example.
So what if the woman,
or for example, if I were to start tweeting about how bad the company I work for is, that's just not smart, or how bad I think that my CEO is doing, for example. Like, those are clearly conflicts of interest.
Okay, but attacking your own company is not really a political statement as such. I mean, I suppose it could be, depending on what your company was involved in. But they, just to track back to the women's shelter thing, what if the women's refuge in question had a policy that actually it would not let trans women into the refuge?
Well, then there's no problem with them employing that individual, is
right.
there? I don't think that women's shelter should have that policy.
Right.
But there's no conflict of interest there between the two. But like, there's a couple of things that I want to acknowledge here. As well, that like, literally I was just scrolling through Twitter because not just now,
because like, yeah, I'm finding this conversation boring.
Yeah, I wasn't finding you that boring, Jimmy. I saw an example of a mixed race person had been quote unquote cancelled by one of their fans for using a darker skin toned emoji, with kind of like the hand emojis, you know, that you can adjust the skin tone of some of them, and there's some selections. And this person is mixed race, but is on the lighter side, has a lighter skin tone, and has been cancelled because they used a skin tone that this individual deemed as being inappropriate from them.
When you say cancelled, you mean boycotted by that one individual who was upset?
Well, this is the thing. What does cancelled mean?
I think it can mean a bunch of different
like
things.
Yeah, exactly, which is kind of one of the problems, right? Frankly, using J.K. Rowling as an example, she has quote-unquote been cancelled, but bookshops still sell her books.
I don't think she has been cancelled by any definition, to be honest. I'm not even sure that she claims she's been cancelled, although she would certainly say that she's received a lot of abuse for expressing her opinions about trans
like
rights.
Then who has been cancelled, Jimmy? Because I think this is probably part of the problem, because nobody has a clear definition of what being quote-unquote cancelled is. And as the person who wrote the article, Can We Cancel Culture, Jimmy, I was hoping you'd maybe come with some clearer definitions.
So I think the two examples you used initially were actually not really examples of cancel culture. What they were examples of were of somebody making a public statement that violated or went against some company policy. And therefore, effectively, what you're talking about is somebody being dismissed for, you know, publicly criticizing a company, which in a lot of job contracts, there is an explicit clause that says you're not allowed to do that. So that strikes me as something quite different from what is usually being referred to. I mean,
okay. What are you talking about when we talk about cancel culture, though? Is it criticism of somebody online?
So, for example, I mean, this decision was later overturned, but there was a shop worker. I think it was for a supermarket. I think it might have been Asda or something. Who posted a video on their personal Facebook page. I think it was a stand-up comedian criticizing Islam. I think it was a Billy Connolly routine offhand. And basically a colleague who saw it reported it to management, and the management said, well, that's offensive to, it could be offensive to some of your colleagues, so we're going to have to dismiss you from your job here. That to me is an example of cancel culture. And I'm fairly sure it was actually
overturned. But that's a breaching of your contract with your employer. If your employer says that you have, like, that seems like a HR issue. Like, saying offensive jokes while you're at work in front of colleagues.
Well, no,
he didn't find that stuff offensive.
He didn't do any of that. He posted it on his Facebook page outside of work.
Right. Yeah, I don't really know where I stand on that, and I don't know the example of the of what was said, so I don't know.
But I find it slightly crazy.
I'm not sure that is cancel culture. That's not my understanding of it either. My understanding of cancel culture is the encouraging deep and like, actually, I'm not talking about the kind of example that you're talking about there at all, really, which is kind of individual jobs, and I'll come into that in a second.
Right.
But I think cancel culture is more widely people who have platforms who are deemed as being inappropriate of having those platforms. I think about people like Shane Dawson, who's a YouTube creator who recently was again criticized for doing blackface in 2012, and a similar thing with Jenna Marbles, who has a similarly large audience, who has said some offensive things around race in the past as well. And she's decided to not post videos on her channel for the foreseeable future. Mm. And I also think of people choosing not to economically, to stop following and disengage from people whose views on certain issues they have voiced and they disagree with, which, like, I as a, and also deciding not to engage economically with people or organizations or retailers or whatever whose values do not align with your own.
Mm.
Now, I see my kind of, like, I don't understand how you're supposed to police that. Like, for example, if I decide, I see what was happening in Leicester around, I think, like, was it Boohoo and those suppliers, right? Those internet suppliers. I see
you're
that they
about
were
online retailers, like clothing retailers.
Yeah, so online retailers who were like, there was exploitative employment practices in some of the places that they
were sourcing clothes from.
That they worked. That they were sourcing clothes. Yeah. Thank you. I think that I should then, as a consumer, be allowed to criticize that, to choose not to engage economically with that with that company.
So just stop buying
and encourage
stuff from
others
them.
Yeah, and encourage others to do so, thereby hopefully stopping that company from existing through my retraction of my capital and people around me's capital, or change their stance.
Right.
I don't understand how you're supposed to, like, what not doing that would look like. I think that maybe, like, cancel culture is more prevalent, and that kind of action is more prevalent because, frankly, there is more information and there are more quote-unquote receipts for this kind of behavior. But what am I meant to do? Not like, if I choose to not support companies and individuals who I disagree with, then that is my right as an individual and as a consumer, no?
Yeah, so I think this is what's been apparent to me, actually, when I've been reading a lot of people who are, you know, who defend or are more sympathetic towards cancel culture, you know, notwithstanding that we don't have a clear meaning for that, is that different things seem to fall under the bracket, because what you're talking about is sort of boycotts and divestment, really. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, is something that's been going on for a very long time. Obviously, there's a whole, I mean, effectively, the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement against Israel is an attempt to cancel an entire country, to some degree.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I think that's true.
But I think that one of the things that was conflated is that, and there was a piece in the New Statesman, that sort of conflated the two issues of, like, somebody losing a job because of something that they'd said politically that was disagreeable versus somebody losing a job because they'd been outed as a sex pest. Let's say the sort of put together the Me Too movement and like, sort of free speech, cancel culture. I think those are two very different things. Just because you think that somebody shouldn't really lose a job because they've said something politically disagreeable, that's very different from, it's not the same thing as saying somebody should keep a job if they've been accused of, you know, sexual misconduct by half a dozen people. I think you can treat those two things separately. Equally, I think that there, in one sense, I'm not really sure how practical it is to only do business with people who politically agree with you, or at least politically agree with you on the important things. I think to have a functioning society, to have a pluralistic society, you need people to transact with, you know, other people who have different political beliefs to them.
Sure, but how are you going to make me do that?
I don't propose any way to make you do that, actually. I would probably be in favour, the more I think about it, of some sort of law that meant that somebody couldn't be sacked for expressing a political opinion. I think that would actually be quite positive in many ways and would enhance free speech in a very meaningful way for a lot of people. Probably with some exemptions for maybe political parties and newspapers, because, or, you know, campaigning organisations, let's say. But, you know, I don't think somebody should, to go back to that example, be sacked from Asda for, you know, posting some humour that would be interpreted as Islamophobic by some people. I think that that sort of thing should be protected. But
yeah, but so I think obviously, again, I don't know the details of that particular case. But if you are posting something which is then public and can be seen by anybody, and then, like, say you have to, like, your customers are, some of them are going to be Muslim, people you work with are going to be Muslim, but you insist on keeping that as a public as a public thing, I can understand why an employer would have problems with an employee insisting on keeping that kind of content up. Does that make sense? I don't think that somebody should be fired because they have said something Islamophobic in their private life and somebody then shares that. But if that is a piece of content that is there and is and cannot be taken down, I think that's different. But I can't really express why that's different. Does that make sense?
I can see why I'm assuming it's Asda. I can see why the supermarket reacted the way it did in that instance. I mean, roughly for the reasons you just described, I think. But if you're not allowed to publicly say certain things, and I think, you know, criticism and jokes about Islam, it should be acceptable. I think it's a good thing to have the ability to criticize religions in that way, sometimes in a very, you know, very harsh and mocking way. If you don't have that, I don't think you have free speech in any meaningful sense. And I know we can draw different lines as to what we think is acceptable or unacceptable, but surely the criticism of ideology, whether it be political or religious or whatever else, is central to all free speech, I think. So I would not support I think your side of the argument in that particular instance. And I mean, when you said you think it's different, what exactly do you think it is different to?
I think of the private space and the public space, and for many people that is very blurred because of social media. Yeah. People interpret social media very often, less and less so to be fair, but they interpret social media as being a private space, whereas actually it isn't. It's probably the most public space that has ever existed. And I can understand expressions of a view from an employee in a public space being reasons for grounds of dismissal, because it can make it difficult for them to continue to do their job, for example.
I mean, you must be aware, and anyone with any sanity must be aware, that of all the people you work for, there's going to be some people in there who will disagree with you on a political issue that is very important to you. You know, they might be not obsessed with abortion, but to, you know, give it an example for a second time, you could be working, I mean, probably not you given the company you work for, but I could be working with someone who thinks that abortion should be illegal in most circumstances, for instance. And there's all sorts of other things. And, you know, if somebody posts something on their Facebook saying, you know, I really disagree with abortion, I think it should be illegal, you know, maybe that is offensive to some other people that they work with, but I don't think that they should have a right to demand that they lose their job over it or take the post down.
I think that abortion is a bad example because it is I don't think your belief in abortion is necessarily kind of like a protected attribute.
Somebody could be offended.
It's not linked to a minority.
Well, it's linked to women, who I know are not a minority, but in a numerical sense, but are a minority in sort of the political sense. And also, it affects people who have had abortions. If you've had an abortion and somebody says, "I think abortions are immoral," what could be more offensive than that?
Yeah, I don't know, Jimmy. I think it's messy. But also, I think that this is it should be a case-by-case basis. Sometimes it is inappropriate on what is said and where it is said. And sometimes people should, a company should be able to fire their employee for saying that.
I think you might have an argument if he'd sent like a round-robin email with this video in. And persisted in sending similar videos after being warned not to do so, I think you might have an argument. But I think Facebook pages are, I get that they are public, and
but that's our modern day equivalent of a round robin email.
No, it isn't. I mean, for what,
who sends round robin emails anymore, granddad?
I mean, internal company communications are distinct from, I mean, you know, essentially it's a Facebook page is a personal web page, isn't it?
But I think that is clearly, if he's using company resources to disseminate that, that is clearly that's clearly a case for dismissal. I don't think that there's an argument there. Mm. But if it is in the public sphere in the way that maybe sometimes a Twitter or a Facebook post can be, there has to be some nuance there, because sometimes that can make it untenable to do their job. Moving on just quickly from this, I think we've set out our stalls quite effectively. Well done, both of us. The thing that I think, I can't remember if I found this from a retweet from you or not, but there was a string of tweets from Theresa Bajan, who's a professor of politics at Oxford, who talked about the implications of, oh god, I'm gonna completely butcher this, para-Hesiatic speech.
Oh, that does sound which something is, I might have retweeted, possibly.
It does sound and that sounds on brand, doesn't it? Which is the sense of being able to speak freely and frankly. So, the fact that we talk about free speech is not just about the ability to say anything, but the ability to feel like you can say anything without fear or favour towards one audience and how they might react. And I think that's something that I've talked about, but that I've written about in academia with surveillance in China. The chilling effect of online discourse, where people know that there are consequences to things that they will say. It is a government entity generally more than the mob, as it is in the West. But it means that people are less likely to say particular things, and so therefore their speech isn't free.
Well, it's inhibited, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's like there isn't actually anything that's stopping you from saying it, but the environment around you stops you from feeling like you can say that. And that is something that I do worry about with the amount of, I mean, I know we haven't defined cancel culture very well here, but around the culture of cancel culture, I really do worry about that, because people should be allowed at a really basic level, they should be allowed to say the wrong thing, but they should be able to say something that is maybe ignorant, and they should be able to say stuff that is offensive and wrong, because otherwise you have you basically have the thought police, and I think that is bad. And it also means that ideas can fester in closed off places that demonize particular groups or whatever. It drives certain ideologies
underground. It's baffling to me that you said this at the end, because it seems to go so against what I perceive to be the implications of your stance on, say, the supermarket case or, you know, something similar to that.
So this is why I said I'm evolving on the issue.
Right.
I see two freedoms kind of in conflict here. One of them is your freedom, what is it, what did she say again, what's the long word, parahesiastic speech.
I don't think we should be encouraging that sort of language, to be honest.
Speech. The ability to speak without
fear of
being
ostracization,
judged.
Let's say.
And also my right to be offended by something, to criticize it and to take action on a stance that somebody has based on what they have said. I think that those two things should exist, but they seem to be in conflict.
I think,
and
they
so
are
there
in
has
conflict,
to be kind
yeah.
of like they are. But I want both of those things to exist, and I think that they have to exist. But there's obviously kind of like a sway and a give and take between those two kind of ideologies, I guess. And there's certainly stuff, bringing it back to kind of like that cancelling of the influencer who used an emoji skin color that was too dark. Like, that's an example of it clearly going too far. And and when I see stuff like that, I worry about it. But I'm always thinking about it. But I think that those, broadly, those are the two things that I think should be able to exist and need to exist. But I am also very aware that they are both in conflict with one another. And so maybe there has to be this constant to and fro, you know?
Well, I think I'm probably...
Jimmy, can we just pause for a second? Because I'm so deep.
You certainly think you're deep, which is similar. Similar. I think in general I'm not saying you're anti free speech, but I think I'm more pro free speech than you are, and I think I'm more.
All right, it's not a competition, is it, Jim? Well,
I'm only saying that because I sort of wanted to respond to those two sort of rights you outlined, if we're going to call them those. The right to speak freely is something I think I'm more in favour of than you. The right to take action against speech you don't like, I'm a little bit more suspicious of, to be honest. I mean, obviously,
look at us, we are the yin to each other's yang.
I don't think you can oblige somebody to transact with a company who has an employee whose political views they dislike. Like, as you say, I can't practically force you to go shop somewhere where, you know, you have a disagreement politically with that business or whatever. That's just not going to happen. But I think in general it would be healthy to inculcate a culture whereby people tolerate political disagreements. And I think, you know, there are problems with defining cancel culture and all of that stuff, but I think there is an unhealthy atmosphere where people are increasingly trying to restrict other people's speech, stopping them from speaking freely and frankly, to use that woman's turn of phrase, you know, by boycotting them or like shouting them down on social media or, you know, calling for resignations and whatever. I don't think this is good for society on the whole. I think it's probably only going to increase divisions between people, because if you say something and then you're fired for saying that thing, it's probably not going to change your mind. You're probably not going to change your opinion. In fact, it might entrench your opinion even further, and you might get a persecution complex and all the rest of it. So that, you know, that's why I'm generally quite critical of cancel culture for that reason.
We stop using cancel culture. We don't know what it means. Is I think the major takeaway from this.
It's hard to pin down exactly, but it's like pornography. You know, what it is when you see it.
Wow. No, I just wasn't expecting that comparison.
That was a reference I was going to say famous court case, but clearly you're not aware of it. So
no, I'm
maybe not,
not
so famous.
Cool. All right, let's wrap up then. Where can they find you on the internet, Mr. Nichols?
Find me at JDE Nichols if you want to cancel me on Twitter. All applications gratefully received.
I almost constantly want to cancel you on Twitter. I think that your speech should be very much taken away.
Maybe we just need to offer a few heads, and then everyone else will get let off. Staying a couple of us.
And you can stop talking. I need to tell people where they can find me so they follow me. I'm at Jazza John on all internet social media. That's a motorbike. Okay, shall we go now? Bye.
We can go. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Bye bye. Excuse me.